This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. As a child of the segregated South, your formative years were in the 1950s and early 60s. Your mother, who was white, was someone you mostly feared. Your family's maid, who was black, was someone you adored and absolutely loved. How would such experience affect your view of the world? That question underlies much of the novel Apron Strings. But although it's fiction, the author readily admits much of the story is drawn from her own childhood. That author is with us this hour. So whether you have a question for her, a story of your own about confusing childhood experiences with race, or you just want to sit back and listen to a fascinating tale, our conversation with first-time novelist Mary Maroney begins right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The novel is set in late 1950s Virginia, and it is titled Apron Strings. Its author from Orange, Virginia, is our guest, Mary Maroney. Welcome to Virginia Insight.
Thank you, Tom. It's delightful to be here.
So how close is the story in this novel to what you experienced in your own childhood?
That depends on the day.
Oh, I can see this is going to be fun.
Today, it's pretty close. I had a black maid whose name was Lottie, and Ethel is definitely based on Lottie, and Lottie's in my relationship.
So we probably should name some of the key characters.
Okay.
Sally, age 7 at the time the novel opens, is probably the main character, and she narrates the majority of the book. Ethel is the family's maid, who Sally just adores. Sally has 2 sisters and 1 brother.
Yeah, the oldest sister, Stuart, and then there's Gordy, the older brother, and then there's Sally, and then Helen.
Who's the baby of
the baby of the family.
And Ginny?
Ginny is Sally's mother. And Jenny and Ethel have known each other since they were girls.
And then Joe Mackey.
Joe Mackey is Sally's father and Jenny's husband. Joe came from New York and really has a hard time trying to figure out the Southern family he's involved himself in.
Okay, for you listening, there's going to be a test on this later, but we'll repeat some of these names. And to start, the main characters we're going to talk about are Sally, the primary narrator, who's the 7-year-old girl, and Ethel, who occasionally comes in as a narrator, and she's the family's maid. Sally is white, and Ethel is black. And this is all happening in Charlottesville, where you, Mary Maroney, grew up.
Yes, I grew
up. So let's talk again about how close this novel is to what happened when you were a child in the 1950s in Charlottesville.
The bones of the story are my life. The story itself is just a story. My family wasn't interesting enough to write a memoir, and so I chose to write fiction, and I took most of the characters I knew as a child, and I sort of mixed them up as if I were shuffling a deck of cards. I took characteristics from some people. I made up some things. My sisters both insist that they are in the novel, and I said, well, I don't know. Did you do that? No. Well, did you do that? No. Well, then maybe it's not you.
So what are you hoping that people who read this novel are going to get out of it?
I want people to get out of this novel that things aren't always what they hear in the news or read in history books, that people have all kinds of people have all kinds of relationships. There's love can happen between races. People can relationships, social standing, race, creed have really nothing to do with how people interact with each other unless you choose that to be a problem.
In your childhood, as a child of a white, at least middle class, maybe upper middle class family. Your father was a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
You had a black maid. Her name was Lottie. So the nonfiction version of the story is a little girl named Mary and a black maid named Lottie. And what was your relationship with Lottie?
It's not too dissimilar from Sally's and Ethel's relationship. I'm not Sally in the story, but everybody I know that has read the story says that, yes, in fact, I am. But I didn't see myself as Sally, and I didn't write Sally as if she were me. But I had a relationship like Sally has with Ethel. I followed her around when she worked. I loved being with her. She was pivotal in my life as far as who I am and decisions I make about things. She taught me not to take myself too terribly seriously, not by saying don't take yourself too seriously, but just by laughing at herself, making herself the focus of humor when things weren't necessarily going the way she thought they ought to. She'd laugh. And I learned that. I also was fortunate enough to have two parents that had good senses of humor. And a sense of humor is a wonderful, wonderful experience.
There's some pretty overt racism, which I guess you would expect in segregated Virginia in the 1950s, that comes up in this novel, and some that's in more subtle form. And maybe we can get into some of that when a little bit later in the hour, Mary Moroney, we get you to read some passages from this book. But how similar to what you recall from your childhood are the experiences of how whites viewed blacks and blacks viewed whites?
I was pretty removed from the whole political segregation thing. I didn't know anything about it. I thought it was odd that we all of a sudden started going to school in basements. Nobody told me what was going on, and I was too young to know. I just went to school.
So this is when you were in elementary school, was the time of the massive resistance in Virginia, which was the
I think it was 1957.
To not proceed with court-ordered desegregation. And there were schools in Virginia, including some in Charlottesville, that closed down public schools rather than white parents allowing their children to go to school with black children. And you experienced that.
I did. And it was interesting. In writing the book, I actually did do a little research. I didn't do a lot of research, but I did do a little research because I never really knew why the schools closed. I mean, I assumed it was a racist thing, but I didn't really know, and I never actually asked anybody. So when I was writing this, I studied the whole massive resistance and discovered only recently that there were only two schools in Charlottesville that were closed. It was Venable, the elementary school, which I happened to be attending, and Lane High School, the high school, which my sisters attended. So, and that was because they were the only two schools that a judge had ordered to let black children into. The rest of the schools in Charlottesville just went on as if nothing had happened because there were no children, there were no black children being forced into their schools.
Mary, let me see if I can approach the question from a completely different direction and admit that one of the reasons I'm intrigued by what must have been some of your experiences as a child that were so different from mine is that I grew up in a northern state in upstate New York, not only in a completely segregated school where almost all of the children were white, but basically a segregated community where it was rare to see a person of color. I remember the first time I might have been 4 or 5 years old that I noted that there were people around who had skin color different than mine, and this is maybe the early 1960s. My grandfather owned a small farm that he did not farm, that rented out, and then there were larger farms around it in a rural area 30 or 40 miles outside of Rochester, New York. And we'd go there on vacations, and once I noticed some people with different skin color out in the fields harvesting crops. And I said to Pa, my grandfather, who are those people? And he said, and this is a quote, "Oh, those are the colored folk that come up every summer to harvest the crops." I went, okay. My family didn't talk much about people of color. The only other major thing I can recall about experiences of people with a skin color different than mine was I was maybe now 7 years old, and I had a stepmother in my life at that time, and we were standing in front of an elevator at the big department store in downtown Rochester, New York, which was called Sibley's. And a man came up, and he had very dark skin, and so I knew he was a quote-unquote colored person. And the elevator door opened, and he held the door, and he said to my stepmother, he said, "Well, you go first." And she said, "Oh, no, no, I'm waiting for my husband. You just go right ahead." And so the man smiled, and he got on the elevator. And the door closed, and I turned to my stepmother, and I said, "Why didn't we go on the elevator?" Because I knew Daddy was not going to be coming to join us. I knew that she had told a fib. And she said, "Oh, colored people smell bad. Never get on an elevator with one." That kind of experience of mine was completely different than your experience of people whose race was different than yours when you were a child. And I was hoping you could tell us about it.
Great question, Tom. I have to say that I've always had a problem with the idea that I'm not going to do a Song of the South thing. I'm not going to do zippity-doo-dah. This, it was all great and wonderful. But I think that at least in my experience, white people and black people had relationships. And they weren't necessarily fair, but then life isn't fair. And life and relationships in life aren't fair. So anyway, they had relationships and they knew each other. And I think one of the worst things or the things that create the most racism is that you don't know. It's the unknown. But if you have a relationship with somebody, it really doesn't make any difference if they're white, black, green, yellow, if you have a relationship, because then you're dealing with the essence of the person. And I was lucky. I got to see Lottie every day, and I knew her as a human being. I didn't know her as a black woman. I didn't know her as a colored. I knew her as Lottie. And that was, I think, a real privilege. And I find that many people that had the relationship I had with Lottie, and there are a lot of them, have sort of the same feeling that I wouldn't be here today if that person weren't my life. So race is almost superfluous in this question. So and I think your story really illustrates how insidious racism is, because there you are, a little boy, and your stepmother is operating in a way that really makes an impact on you. And you didn't even know black people. You had no concept of it except for this one experience, and that's pretty profound experience.
Well, to you who are listening, I'm curious, how old were you when you first noticed that some people had a different skin color from your own? Is there a story about how that realization first came to you? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. If you prefer all numbers, then 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can find us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Set in the late 1950s in Charlottesville, Virginia, the novel is titled Apron Strings. It was written by a woman who herself spent most of her childhood in Charlottesville in the 1950s and early 1960s, Mary Maroney. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We got 15 seconds before we hit the break for you to give us one other revelation of how this mirrors your own life.
My daughter, all my children were, I had a black maid that helped me take care of my children. She didn't do it as exclusively as Lottie did, but I did. And she also, her name was Ruth Green, and she also took care of my granddaughter.
Okay, we've got more questions when we get back in a bit more than 1 minute. Mary Maroney is our guest. Her novel, Apron Strings, is our focus. So let's jump right into near the beginning. You've got your book open to page 2. Could you read a few paragraphs of this for us, please, Mary Maroney?
I can do that, but I just want you to know I write better than I read. I grew up thinking that Ethel and my mother were as close as any two friends could be, despite the fact that it was 1957. Even to a child, that seemed unbelievable, considering they were so different in color, shape, and attitude. Friendship had to be next to impossible. In Virginia, it was against the law for a colored person to drink from the same water fountain as a white. Yet for as long as I could remember, 13 hours a day, 6.5 days a week, my mother and Ethel shared their lives. Well, that's not quite true. My mother shared her life. Ethel listened and edited her own. And despite their disparate worlds, their views were remarkably similar, their thoughts intertwined like neglected perennials in an old flower bed. Each of us children was named for somebody else. My sister Stuart was the oldest and the prettiest. She'd just turned 14. She hated her name, though I don't know if that was because it sounded like a boy's name or because it was my mother's maiden name. Next oldest to Stuart was my brother Gordy, just 9 at the time. Gordy was named after my mother's brother, Gordon Stuart. Then there was me, Sally, 7, and named after Daddy's father, Sally. It was an unusual and an unfortunate name for a man, as far as I was concerned. I was happy to be a girl. Helen, at just 4.5, was the baby of the family and was named for my father's mother, who died days before Helen was born. It was lucky that Helen was a girl. I think my parents would have gone right ahead with the name, even if the baby had been a boy. I can't imagine a boy on earth who would have been able to tolerate Helen as a name. The house we lived in was big like a mansion of the old South, butter-colored stucco with enormous fluted columns and dark green, almost black shutters on the floor-to-ceiling windows in the front. It sat in one of the tree-lined neighborhoods that rimmed the University of Virginia, where my father had gone to law school. It was the prettiest house on the street. My mother said if it hadn't been, she would never have allowed Daddy to buy it because of the tacky houses that ran down the side of the property line. Not charming like slave quarters, she'd say to almost any visitor. Just tacky post-First World War housing. I didn't know why she thought slave quarters were so charming. The ones I'd seen had been nothing but old, rotten, weed-choked, fallen-down sheds. She definitely wouldn't have wanted those next door. I think the thing she hated most about those houses was their proximity. When our kitchen door was open, you could hear the neighbors talking. The houses were that close. So unless it felt like it was 1,000,000 degrees inside, she always insisted that our kitchen door stay closed.
Mary Maroney, reading from her novel, Apron Strings. If you'd like to talk to her, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. Next to Stanton, Ellen, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Hi. I was telling your screener, I grew up in the North, and I never heard any racial disparities at all, but it was the time of the riots, and every family in my neighborhood had a black maid. And I asked my mother during the riots, when they were reporting about all the damage that the colored and Negro people were doing, I asked her why we didn't know any colored or Negro people, and she pointed out that we knew Miss Blanche and all the others. And I argued with her because I could not believe that Blanche was colored or Negro, because all the colored and Negro people were involved in the riots doing bad things. And so I was convinced that we did not know any black people. Good people were white, bad people were black. And I didn't realize until I was much older that that was part of my psyche, that I wasn't told that. We never used any racial disparities in my home, but that's how I was brought up to believe.
Ellen, I think that's so true of so many people, that we were brought up to believe, we were brought up not believing that we were given racial disparities, but the fact that somehow you got the idea that white was good and black was bad is definitely a racial disparity, and you got that somehow. Stuff is
right.
Subtle.
Right, and I believe, and even faced with her dark skin color, I was convinced that she must be white because she couldn't do anything bad.
I think that's the way children think, too. I think children are innocent and sweet, and they like to They like to think the best of people, and so the reality of the situation is the woman that was in your household was good to you, so how could she be bad? So she must be white.
Ellen, thank you so very much for your call. So let me get back to a previous question that I was trying to get to, Mary Maroney, of your own experience in a home with brothers and sisters in a white upper middle class family in Charlottesville in the 1950s with a black maid. To what degree were you aware of skin color?
I don't think I was aware of it at all. I think I was like Ellen. There was just that Lottie was Lottie, and that was the way it was. She had friends that came over, and I knew that they didn't look the same as I did, but it wasn't like they're bad or they're black or they're colored or, well, I guess I did know they were colored, but I didn't know that there's any huge difference because they were people I saw all the time.
In the novel that you've written, Apron Strings, it does seem to me that your main character, Sally, who's 7 years old at the time the story begins, is remarkably aware that some people are outright racist, that some people are saying nasty things about other people because they are quote-unquote colored. Even the next-door neighbors, the Dabney family, we may get into a section that you've got Mark to read about them, would look with great hostility at the Mackeys, the family starring in this novel, whenever a black person came in their driveway. And there's an episode where the white children are playing with what they think of as a little colored boy, and that's considered forbidden. From those things that I recall from reading the novel, Mary, it seems to me that Sally was quite aware that at least the white people around her had varying attitudes towards people of color. Did you have that experience?
No, and that's one of the reasons why I'm not Sally. She was way more aware than I ever was. I lived in sort of a la-la land that this was, I lived in a pretty white world with black features. And most of this segregation thing was whirling around in a world that I wasn't aware of. And until it became apparent because I had to go to school. I didn't go to school anymore, but I had to go to school in a house off of, in a neighborhood somewhere away from where I lived. And we actually got bus there. That was the first time I ever rode a school bus. I still didn't know because I was going to school with white children. And then after that whole brouhaha got resolved, they created a school that was, I think it was called the Charlottesville Education Foundation, so that you didn't have to go. It was a kind of quasi private school, and you didn't have to go to the public schools. And I went to that school, and we were and there's an episode in the book actually where it reflects the real life thing about our black yard man used to drive us to school, and we were aware enough to know that for some reason we were going to a school that didn't want black children to go to, but we were being driven by a black man, and it was amazingly embarrassing. And we were embarrassed. I remember being embarrassed not only for me but for our driver. He was so, I mean, I don't know that he cared, but I really was embarrassed for him. And the kids in the car that were neighbors that we did the carpool with were embarrassed too, and they didn't understand it because they didn't have blacks in their life, so it was awkward and strange.
I'm curious, Mary Maroney, if you can recall when you became aware that there was such a thing as racism and what you thought about that.
I actually think it was in the backseat of my mother's car where the kids in the neighborhood were talking about how embarrassing it was to have this man who they didn't know and who they didn't like drive them to school. And they would make disparaging remarks. And I was not quite sure they didn't seem to understand because I knew him. They didn't. What was going on here? And I did try to make things a little bit better, and it didn't work. And I remember feeling, well, gosh, maybe I should be embarrassed too. And we were. My sister and brother and I were embarrassed at times that these people were talking about a man that we knew that they didn't know, and felt that racism, it was so much of a bigger topic than we were capable of handling. And it wasn't a topic that was available for conversation. You didn't come home and say, hey, the kids in the car were really making fun of Dewey. What do we do about that? It wasn't a question that I could ask my mother, and I didn't want to ask Lottie. So I assumed that since I didn't want to ask Lottie, I really was more aware of her otherness than I am actually fessing up to.
Lottie was your family's black maid.
Lottie was my family's black maid.
How similar is she to the character Ethel, who is the black maid in your novel?
Ethel looks just like Lottie. Ethel acts a lot like Lottie, but not completely. Lottie had had less, I think Lottie, I don't know Lottie's background. That's an interesting thing. It's one of the things I said about Ethel. She edited her own life. I don't know the story of Lottie's life. I know a few things that she worked when she was really young, and I do know that she got a nickel or a dime a day when she worked all day long. I did know that, and I knew that she worked for a family and raised a whole nother family besides my family before she came to us. Other than that, I don't know anything, and it wasn't because I didn't ask questions. She just wasn't giving me the information. So,
was there some point in your life when you began to feel that you were, I don't know what the word is, Mary Maroney, innocent or ill-informed about race, about racism?
Oh, yeah.
About the challenges of people who were living different lives than privileged upper-class white people?
Oh, absolutely. I think I might have been 30 years old when I finally figured that out. I lived in a pink bubble. I wasn't aware. I didn't know. I had the people that I knew seemed to be happy with their life. We had nice relationships. We supported each other. We loved each other. And the other stuff was far removed from me and my life, so I didn't know about it. I've never been a big newspaper.
When you say
reader.
The people you knew, you're talking about the people you knew who were white, the people you knew who were black, and your, I guess, complete lack of awareness that somebody in the 1950s trying to survive on pay of a dime a day was struggling.
Well, that wasn't the 1950s when she was being paid a dime a day. That was back in the 20s when she was a little girl. Not that she was paid an exorbitant amount of money, but finance was not something a kid in the 50s had any idea about. I mean, I got a dime from the Tooth Fairy, and that was about the... As a matter of fact, when I was looking for newspaper articles about segregation, I found a newspaper article that said, it's a great big giant in the Daily Progress newspaper article, that said, bankers are teaching women about money. And I thought, So that it was a whole different world as far as money was concerned back then.
Mary Maroney is our guest. Her novel, Apron Strings, is our focus. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We've got some phone lines open at 888-WMRA Talk. And here on the Virginia Insight Facebook page, we have this Mary from Neil, who says, this topic is too large. I grew up in Georgia, and we had helpers for various reasons, housekeeping, helping at a funeral. Skip past the civil rights movement when young people came from the North to show us how to live, show in quotes. Then zoom to 1983 when my daughter was a six-year-old. My mother-in-law asked my daughter, are there any black children in your class? My daughter said no. The fact was Emily's best friend was black. Emily even got a black doll for Christmas.
I agree. The topic's too large, and I think I think it goes back to that show you had the other day when they were talking about whether black people felt pain differently than white people. And I think one of the professors said something about it has a lot to do with the fact that when people know each other, it's different than when they don't know each other. So when you objectify something, it's a huge thing. And when you subjectify it, it becomes a manageable proposition. And little... the little girl in this particular example didn't know she had black, because black, you know, black mean, you know, it's like left hand and right hand. It's in just, it's inherent almost in our language that black is bad and white is good. I don't believe that. I'm going to hasten to add, I don't believe that that's the case, but I think it's built almost into the language. So when a little girl, no matter what era she lives in, is asked if she had a black woman in her, or there's a black person in her life and she likes this person, she's going to say no, because I think children are pretty clear about stuff that's black or white. It's black or white. It's either black or white.
Next to Charlottesville, Carolyn, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for novelist Mary Maroney, please.
Yes, I'd like to know why you wrote the novel. What inspired you, and were you considering to writing another?
Well, yeah, what inspired me was the relationship I had with Lottie and the fact that I had never, in all the reading I've done, ever seen it explored to the extent that I thought it should be explored, because I thought there was a lot of drama. I thought it was, there was a lot of pathos, and so I decided to write the novel, and it's based on the relationship I had with a woman who was vitally important to me. And yes, I am going to write, and I've got a cookbook that I'm writing that's called Ethel Cooks Good Food, and I brought Tom some famous Ethel marmalade tarts today so he could try them out, because I'm testing out my recipes, because I've made up the recipes based basically on the recipes that Lottie, my family's maid, used to cook.
Ethel is the fictional maid in the novel.
I know there are a lot of names.
Lottie is the actual maid who
in the life
worked for your family,
right,
during your childhood. Carolyn, does that ask your question? Did you have a follow-up?
No, that's fine.
Thank you so much. And I think I said asked, or meant to say answered. But Carolyn, thanks for taking the time to call us. Let's go next to Orange. This is Betsy. Betsy, your question or comment for Mary Maroney, please.
Mary, I had a very different experience. I was raised in California in the 50s and 60s. And my parents believed that if people looked different than us, they were very special. And we should celebrate everybody's differentness. And the more people that we knew, that, the more special we were. Does that make any sense?
I'm sorry, Betsy. There was a little breakup on our connection with you. So would you repeat that? Your parents thought the more...
That the more friends you had that were different than you, and you should celebrate people's uniqueness, that it made you more special because you had all these very different friends. And so... You know, having black friends was unique and exotic, and we learned to love their food, and Mexican friends and Japanese friends. And so I just didn't grow up with this same sense. And so I've always been baffled by all these conversations.
Betsy, could you hang on for us? Because we're going to hit the break here in just a moment, and I want to give Mary a chance to respond and maybe have the two of you interact when we get back.
Okay, thank you.
And we will be back in just a bit more than 1 minute. Much of the story in the novel Apron Strings is narrated by a young girl living in a big house near the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. The tale starts in 1957 when the narrator Sally is 7 years old. She has two sisters, one brother, a father, and a mother who are all part of the white upper middle class of that time, and a maid who is black and comes from a quite poor, struggling family. By the way, the author of Apron Strings also lived in 1950 Charlottesville as a child. Her name is Mary Maroney, and she is our guest on this edition of Virginia Insight. We still have Betsy from Orange on the line. So, Mary Maroney, you want to respond to what she was telling us just before the break?
I do. First of all, Betsy, please excuse me for my regional bias, but it sounds like you were fortunate enough to grow up in California, and they have a much more expanded view of people in California, I think, than they did in the South when I was growing up. So I think it's a wonderful thing that you were given the opportunity to embrace all people of all colors and almost collect them as friends, because it makes you a more interesting person. Are you still there, Betsy?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
It didn't help me to understand my my region, my adopted region, when I moved to the East, and I realized that the way I thought was just completely different. And it really kind of set me back for a while, because I found a funny thing that Black people didn't see. They didn't view the things the way I did either, and I wanted to have friendships with Black people, and I felt this real line, and I didn't know how to relate to it.
I think that there's an example of that in the book, where Sally's father is Joe Mackey, comes from New York, and he's sitting at the dinner table at Sally's mother's house, and Ethel is passing food, and Joe's never had any dealings with Black people at all, and particularly as servants. And so when she passes him the peas or whatever it is she's passing him, he takes the peas from her, which was not the way it went, and introduces himself.
Uh-huh.
And goes to shake her hand. And Ethel is affronted, because this is not the way people behave. It's not the way she was brought up to behave, and nobody was to behave uh-huh. like that. So she says, I almost dropped the bowl. And what? And looked at the table, around the table, and all mouths were agape. So I think we're all victims of how we're brought up. We're
right.
all socialized in different ways. And I think it's part of the trick of being a human being to figure out how to get beyond the social mores that we've been brought up with. And they're so invisible, because, like Tom says, you know, his stepmother didn't get into an elevator because somebody had planted that seed in her head. And Tom's going, well, wait a minute, you lied.
Uh-huh.
And there we all are. And none of us know really how to figure it out.
Right.
And it would be really a great thing if all of us made a bigger attempt to walk for a minute and then the other person choose. And I don't for a second suggest that I'm good at it.
Yeah, and I think that I have really, it's been a really good experience for me to live on the East Coast, because I just didn't understand any of this discussion that went on because of maybe the interesting perspectives that people on the West Coast, not that we don't have racism, we have it, but I just wasn't raised with it, and I was around a lot of other people that raised their children similarly.
Betsy, a couple of questions would help me picture your experience,
uh-huh.
if I could get you to help me with this. One is, where in California were you growing up?
I grew up all over the state. I was a very, traveled child.
So Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Diego.
Northern California, rural California, city California. I went to schools with a mixed race population.
And what kind of time frame was this?
I grew up in the late 50s, early 60s. Oh, and I was a little girl during that time. That's when, I think your attitudes are sort of very shaped.
And what time frame did you come to the East and discover a completely different attitude than what you'd been exposed to before?
In the early 80s.
Okay.
And it was a shocking experience for me, because I believed that people were just very logical about it, and I discovered that my understanding of this line, it was just so, there was such a rut here in the East that was still there that I couldn't relate to it.
Well, that's true. When I go to California, there are a lot of things about California I can't relate to
right.
either, because mm-hmm. it's so much more expanded mm-hmm. in so many ways. And I even like to think of myself as an expanded thinker. Mm-hmm. But I go to California, and there are just things that are taken for granted that push against prejudices and bigotries that are just ingrained in my psyche.
Uh-huh. And so it's helpful to me to listen to how other people see it here on this side of the United States, because I just didn't relate to it. I didn't experience it, so it's not easy for me to relate to it. But I appreciate hearing it.
And Betsy, I will tell you that as somebody who did not grow up in the South, and had a completely different childhood experience of race, I found this novel, Apron Strings, absolutely fascinating.
Yes, I think I would like to read it now, especially since I'm also from near Orange.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Betsy.
Lottie, who is the real-life maid of your childhood, Mary Moroney, taught you some lessons about life that you've told me before you try to carry with you all the time. I understand there were three or four of them. Do you remember what they are?
Well, I know the first one is don't take yourself too seriously. And she didn't teach this lesson by saying, now, Mary, don't take yourself too seriously. She lived those things. If things weren't going quite right, she'd find the humor in them. She was quick to make herself the butt of a joke. She laughed a lot. She laughed at me, but not in a cruel or ugly way. She just laughed. And she laughed a lot at herself. And I think the idea that if you laugh, if you're busily laughing at yourself, it's really hard to laugh at somebody else in an ugly way. So that was an important lesson. The second lesson that she taught me was to be accommodating, not to be a princess, to allow people the space to be who they were and make it so that it was possible, because somehow it was just as if you were a bigger person if you could say, okay, well, what do you need? What time do you need to be there? How can I accommodate you? And it doesn't in any way distract from me as a human being, or did it distract from Lottie as a human being if she would accommodate people? And the third one was...
be yourself.
Right, because if you weren't yourself...
I took notes, so I cheated.
It's good that you took notes, because I forgot. If you're not yourself, then you're just a poor imitation, and the world is going to miss out on the you that you are, which is a pretty good thing to do, to be yourself.
And share your failures.
And share your failures, because people just can't relate to your perfection. And most of us are always trying to go out there and show everybody how great and how smart and how wonderful we are, which then brings me to a thing about writing that I think everybody needs to know. I am the world's worst speller. I am such a bad speller that if I thought about it for more than about 10 and a half seconds, I wouldn't be able to write a book. But thank God there's spell check. And when I can't even figure out how to spell the word to look it up, I come up with another one, which improved my vocabulary considerably. So don't let what you think is a limitation stop you.
So these last two rules or lessons that you say you absorbed from your family's maid, Lottie, be yourself and... share your failures.
It's a good thing we wrote those down, huh?
This is something that I also wrote down the first time we talked at length, Mary Moroney. And I think I've got these quotes fairly close to accurate. Please tell me if they're off. Quote, I've had 5 marriages, 4 children, 3 fathers, 2 dead fathers, and been married 25 years to the 5th husband. You can put that on the air if you want. With all the drama and all the trauma that I've had, I've also had the most wonderful life in the world, and I want other people to see that they can get there.
Well, yeah, you just said it all. I'm going to be hard-pressed. I have had all those experiences, and I have to say that the thing that got me through all those experiences were Ethel's unwritten rules that I learned just following her around and asking her questions. Because if I couldn't laugh at myself...
Only in this case, it was actually Lottie.
Oh, right, Lottie.
So you've got Lottie and Ethel transposed.
I've got them all confused now. But that's also because I've got a great big microphone in front of my face. And I'm sitting in a
radio... And I'm such a scary guy to sit in front of. Yes, I can tell.
It's not you. It's all the equipment.
But Ethel is one of the stars of your novel.
Right.
Apron Strings. And Lottie is the real-life maid of your childhood that Ethel, if not is based on, at least you've told us Ethel looks exactly in the book as she's described, as Lottie looked from your memory in your childhood.
Right.
So what is it about going through failure, about going through trauma, that you want other people to know about you so they can take faith, take hope from your experience?
Well, there's definitely hope in all that stuff. If you can survive that, what else? If life continues to throw you a bunch of hardballs and you survive it, then you're a survivor. But I think that that having a sense of humor and an ability to laugh at the things that come at you makes you more than a survivor. I think it makes you stronger. It makes you empathetic. It makes you a person who has confidence in their abilities to live life to its fullest.
What is, if not the hardest thing, at least one of the hardest things that you've lived through that if you thought other people knew about it, they might take hope from it?
I have two children that suffer from bipolar disease, and that is the hardest thing, to see your own children suffer. And for a long time, I was taking on the mental health world to say, okay, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to make these people understand that this is something that needs to be addressed. And finally, it occurred to me that I have to see my children as perfect, just the way they are, and allow them to be who they are and work it out for themselves. So I try to stand back and support them in any way I can without trying to run it for them. So I've given up my helicopter license, and I'm no longer a helicopter parent. And I have to say, I'm really proud of all of my children. I think that they have all had, because, I mean, you can't, three of my four children have lived a proportionately large part of their lives without their fathers. My third child was born after her father died. So they've had their own experiences of hardship and stuff. So I think the best thing I could have done for them and myself is to live my life as hard, as well as I could, with humor.
I'm conscious that we're going to run out of time very soon, but we have somebody who's just called in, Nell in Edinburgh. If you're quick, I think we can fit in your question or comment. Thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight.
Well, thank you so very much, and thank you, Mary, for writing such a wonderful love letter to Lottie. I grew up in Virginia Beach, and we had Eula May, who came in once a week, and she also was the same kind of example in my life. She told me to basically follow my own star through her example. I was 14, and she told me how to pierce my ears against my mother's wishes, but I did it anyway. And I kind of did one of them wrong, and I think about her every single time I look at that lopsided hole in my ear.
Yeah, they didn't always, Lottie certainly didn't always follow the rules of the household. But an interesting part about that was she really ran the household, which I think is interesting as far as power is concerned.
So did you get some really good advice, Nell?
Well, I think that more what I got from Eula May was love and acceptance. My mother was very strict and was not the most loving mother with me, and she was kind of harsh. And Eula May was my soft place to fall. And
that's how Ethel is in the book.
Yeah.
Ethel is the soft place to fall.
And she was just a very special lady, and I miss her terribly. I really do.
I understand that.
She was wonderful. And having been in a Navy family, you know, I spent the first several years in Morocco. And so, you know, we were in a very diverse environment there. And so coming to Virginia in 1960, when I was 6 years old, it was very strange to have all of a sudden, as you say, you know, growing up with these people who had these attitudes.
Nell, I'm so sorry to cut you short, but we are just about out of time. Thanks
for joining us today.
I understand.
I will look for your book. Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you, Nell. Thank you for calling.
It struck me that Nell called your book a love letter to Lottie. In the 15 seconds we've got left, you want to say anything about that?
Well, I wish I'd thought of that. That's really great. It should be the subtitle to the book, because it really is a love letter to Lottie.
Our guest has been Mary Moroney, author of the novel Apron Strings. Mary, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thank you for having me. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you.
Me too.
Oh, good.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Dan Easley, Terry Ward, and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music is supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find postings of Virginia Insight on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. And when you get to the page for today's broadcast, you'll find links to more information about the work Ms. Maroney is doing. Plus, if you go to the Virginia Insight Facebook page and click like, you'll have access to a whole bunch more information about these broadcasts there as well. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham.
I've got to go taste those. What were they? What do we got out waiting to be taste tested?
Famous marmalade tarts.
I can't wait. But I hope we can get together again soon for more insight.